Okay, well, I guess we can get going. So thanks, everyone, for joining. And thanks to Catherine and Marianne, who are presenting today on their work in Boston on methane emissions and then some work on CO2 as well. So we'll have them present, and then we'll take a bit of time at the end to talk about a potential in-person meeting for the working group. So yeah, we could get started with Catherine and Marianne.
Great, thanks, Heather. People should let me know if they can't hear me. I'm actually, my mouth is like almost right on the mic for the speakerphone, but I can try to be louder if I need to be. So I thought for this call that I would try to kind of take a step back and just briefly tell you or give you an update about some of the activities that we have going on in Boston, and then speak specifically about results that we found for methane, and then hand it over to Marianne, who will talk about some recent work that she just started working on with regards to CO2. So next slide, slide two. So just briefly, why are we concerned with making measurements, atmospheric measurements of greenhouse gases in urban areas or our urban area? And there are lots of interesting things that we can think about from this perspective, because cities are large concentrated sources of anthropogenic emissions, and they really capture quite a few different processes in one area. And therefore, they can be used, for example, for tracking and verification of larger scale emissions and trends, because they do represent a large fraction of total emissions. They can be a test bed for linking observations from different platforms covering different scales, because the urban signal is strong and persistent. They can be used, or they offer an opportunity to link our atmospheric observations to underlying flux processes and drivers, because at the scale of individual urban areas, we have the hope or potential to actually understand the sources and their drivers in greater detail. And I think also they offer us an opportunity to translate our results to actionable mitigation strategies, because local governments are more able and willing to engage with us, I think, than our federal agencies. So those are just some of my own reasons for working in this area. Slide three gives just a really quick outline of the types of measurement activities and supporting research activities that we have going on in Boston. So we have a network of ground stations with Bocaro's, five stations in Boston and outside of Boston that we've been running at Harvard since 2012. And those sit within a greater, a larger, what we consider regional framework, where IF Networks has many stations, and there are also a few NOAA stations that sort of constitute what we are thinking of as the regional network for the Northeast. We also have some...
Catherine, we can't hear you.
You can't hear me. Okay. I'm leaning even closer. Okay, so we also have a solar STS, or a group of solar STS, kind of like TCON, but actually cheap and compact, that some other folks in our group are leading, namely Jia Chen and Joe Jones, in collaboration with Kelly Chance. And they're thinking about how these can be used to detect the urban gradient by making column measurements inside and outside of the city. And they're also looking forward to an opportunity to do some comparisons with OCO2, because the track goes right through our area. We also have a group of LIDARs that are measuring aerosol backscatters. And in that sense, they give a rendering of the vertical atmospheric structure, and we hope to use those to sort of check the accuracy of the simulation of the atmospheric structure in our meteorological models. And that effort is being led with Sigma Space by Phil DeCola and Shanina Barrera and Jen Hegarty at AER. So in support of those measurement activities, we also have quite a bit of activity going on at BU in Lucy Hutira's group, where they're working on developing high-resolution models of emissions from a variety of sectors. And then at AER, they're working on the meteorological simulations of work to drive silt and thinking about how best to represent the urban surface in those models. Slide four. So now I was just going to briefly discuss our results for methane in Boston. This is a paper that was published last month, and we're thinking about how to quantify and what the what the total flux is of methane from natural gas specifically in Boston. And the reason that we were thinking about this is because there's been quite a bit of focus on methane emissions from natural gas over the last several years, a lot of concern over that, largely driven by our sort of transforming energy portfolio in the U.S. But the vast majority of that work has focused on production, and very little information is available, nor previous research has been done on methane from natural gas in consuming regions. And in our local area, there's actually quite a lot of interest and concern in this topic because we have very old infrastructure. And you can drive around and see many points of elevated methane, but there was no previous quantitative information available about those emissions. So we thought this network would offer sort of an interesting opportunity to look at this question specifically. Slide five outlines the objectives that we had for this study. Namely, we wanted to quantify the total methane emissions for the entire urbanized region for 1 year. And then we also wanted to quantify the fraction of those emissions that came from natural gas. Then we wanted to equate that to the total amount of natural gas that was delivered and consumed in the region in order to quantify a so-called loss rate, or the fraction of natural gas that entered the area that was actually not combusted, but just directly lost to the atmosphere. And then we also wanted to look at seasonal variations because there was a lot of sort of a folklore about what those should look like, but no information to anchor those impressions too. So the map on the lower right shows the domain that we did the study for. So the four dots show the locations of our observation stations in Boston, where the two dots in the center labeled BU and COP for Copley Square are two urban locations, and then the other two were used as boundary sites, with Harvard Forest in the west and a site on the Haunt Island in the Boston Harbor to the northeast. And so we're optimizing for emissions in the area enclosed by the circle on the map, which is quite a large area. It's much bigger than the city of Boston, but more encapsulates the entire sort of urbanized region around Boston. And we looked at emissions for 1 year, covering 2012 to 2013. And some studies in this area think about emissions from particular natural gas sectors. Since we're doing a top-down study, we're capturing all emissions from all natural gas activities in the region. So those include, we have transmission pipelines feeding the region, of course, distribution pipes feeding the gas to homes and businesses, end-use activities in those homes and businesses. We also have an LNG import facility in Boston Harbor, extensive LNG storage throughout the region, which is used to meet peak demand, and then smattering of CNG vehicle fueling stations. Slide six. So this describes the general outline of the method that we use to look at this question. First, we're using the atmospheric measurements inside and outside of the city to compute the average methane enhancement due to urban emissions. Next, we made measurements of ethane in the atmosphere and collected data on the ethane to methane ratio in the pipeline gas feeding the region, and then we looked at the those relative ratios in order to compute a fraction of emissions in the city. And it's a little bit easier to do that in Boston, one, because we have a very strong signal, and two, because we don't have any production or refining activities for any fossil fuels going on in the region. It's a purely consuming region. So the third component here is the worst-built transport model. So basically, it's a low-ground train particle dispersion model driven by worst meteorology and using that to simulate the sensitivity of those observations to upwind fluxes and then optimize emissions to match the observed enhancement. And then lastly, we created a map, a spatially resolved map of natural gas consumption so that we could actually compute the loss rate because the atmosphere does not follow geopolitical boundaries. So we needed to make our own.
Hi, this is Catherine.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, sorry. Such a disaster. Okay. Sorry, everybody. okay, so I'm on slide 7. This is a picture of a map of our stations around Boston. So we have the two urban stations in the center of the city at Boston University and Copley Square. Those pictures are on the lower left. They're actually really close to each other in the horizontal, but have quite a different height difference. Then we have the two boundary stations, one at Harvard Forest and one on Nahant. And then we actually have a fifth station that was started after this particular study period, so it wasn't used in this study, but will be used in future studies out on Thompson Island in the Boston Harbor.
Hey, Catherine, it's Riley. I have a question. I know you're going to talk about the four corners on the Prue Tower, but for some of the other sites, in particular Lucy's site on the roof of BU,
yeah.
Have you guys looked at the impact of nearby buildings? You know, has anybody done any LES simulations to look at, you know, whether you're having similar issues with the low buildings?
No, we haven't. We haven't really. I think it's not. I agree it's not the most optimal location. The other buildings are not super close, so it's not like in a canyon relative to other buildings. Having the ethane spectrometer up there was really interesting to have some tracers and also the very high time frequency signal. So you could see a tiny, like very short-lived emissions from some standpipes on the roof, for example. But in this case, you know, for this study, we're only using afternoon data, and we get a similar answer for the two. I'm getting an echo. We're getting a similar answer. Sorry, I was getting an echo with Marianne calling in next to me. We're getting a similar answer for the two sites at different heights. So, you know, that gives me some assurance about the sort of mean signal we're getting. But I think if you wanted to start understanding patterns at a higher time resolution, not just one point per day, I think it could be a concern. Those buildings don't really have a ton. Like the tall building, the Copley Square building, has a ton of emissions coming up atop, which is not really true for at BU in the vicinity. So it's kind of like an open, it's a relatively sort of open space. But I think, yeah, there's definitely some space in the literature to do some more extensive research into these issues.
Yeah, I think I just, I guess the thing we've been trying to poke at is, in addition to the local point, the local sources, is there potential bias because of the prevailing wind conditions at the time of day you're sampling where you're being perturbed by a local building? But maybe better to talk about this in the next slide. I'm going to get to talking about the Prue Tower.
Sure. Okay, slide 8 describes a little bit more into what sort of Riley is alluding to. So for the tall building where we're measuring, we have a few challenges. One, that there are multiple large sources coming out of the top of the building. There's the heating and cooling system is venting up there. There is a restaurant up there that's venting, and there's all the sewer vents. And you can see those signals very clearly. So, and then the other more general problem is that you can get all sorts of small-scale circulations around the building. And so then it's hard to know, even if you're at the top of the building on a tower, when are you in the sort of free flowing, when are you sampling sort of the free-flowing atmosphere. So what we did was we put inlets at the four corners of the building, and we're sampling them in sequence with a single instrument at a five-minute interval. And then on the next slide, you can see some example data from that where those show the concentrations of CO2, methane, and carbon monoxide over a few days for the five-minute means from each corner, and then selecting which corner we would consider the upwind corner based on those relative concentrations.
And then, Catherine, on the setup, given the, I don't know how long your lines are, but given this 5 minute cadence, can you say anything about what kind of actual overhead or what kind of yield you're getting? Because you have to account for lag and then the chamber refresh interval. Can you just sense for what kind of duty cycle you're actually getting on sampling?
So we're flushing all the lines continuously with a larger pump. But the delay in the lines, so the lines are really long. We made them all equal, so they all have the same delay time. The delay time is like 5 minutes. So is that what you're asking?
Well, what I'm getting at is you're rotating. There's several things that you have to deal with a single instrument and, multiple ports like this. You have to deal with, settle time, whatever the overhead is required after you switch to a port to get, a good measurement. There's that. And then there's the, how frequently is the wind changing? If you think you're only getting a good sample from one corner at a given time, then the probability that you're getting a good sample over the day. I'm just curious whether you've done statistics on what kind of actual yield or completeness you're getting over the course of a typical day with all of that, taken into account.
So what I did was I just took some data from our other stations that are continuous, and I simulated just a random sub-selection of time, and I basically got the same answer under a variety of conditions. So again, maybe this kind of goes back to the strategy of just averaging everything up quite a bit and not being so concerned about sub-hourly scale changes.
Great.
Okay. Next, slide 10. So this describes the basic approach for the methane observations and an example time series from BU over 3 months. So for the background, we have the two upwind stations, and then we select from those stations based on the simulation of the wind direction from the meteorological model. And then because we don't actually know what the true background is, I made a distribution of potential backgrounds by sampling from between a large range of lower percentiles. And that is displayed in the purple and red lines sort of tracking the bottom, the daily minimums in the observations. And then so I computed a daily enhancement from afternoon hours only, and also tried an alternative strategy, which was to compute a daily enhancement from the minimum hours only. And you basically get a similar, non-statistically different answer in terms of optimized emissions. So whereas the full time series of CO2 or methane concentrations has a huge amount of noise in it when you're just looking at the daily afternoon minimums, basically, quite a lot of that noise is taken out. So slide 11 shows the methane enhancements that we computed using that strategy. So the Boston University site is closer to the ground, so the methane enhancement is a bit larger, around 46 ppb, and the Copley Square site is about 30 parts per billion. And that just shows the seasonal and annual average for the two sites, those figures. Okay, next slide, 12. So this is about the ethane and methane ratios in the gas and in the atmosphere. So we got this data from the transmission companies serving the region. There are three transmission pipelines or companies serving the region, and they report gas content on an hourly basis. It's a FERC-mandated rule, and you can pull that data down from their websites. And this just shows sort of the histograms of those of that ratio for the two time periods where we have ethane measurements from the atmosphere. And so basically the ethane to methane ratio in the pipeline gas had a mean of about 2.5%. Next, slide 13, this shows an example of the ethane and methane in the atmosphere. There's just an example time series in the upper left. They were highly correlated almost all the time. And then we treated the data because we didn't have background observations where we're computing a daily linear fit to afternoon data only to 5-minute medians. And then so all those light lines show the daily fits for two time periods, one in the sort of fall-winter and one in the spring-summer. And then we computed a bootstrapped mean of those daily fits to get the average seasonal ethane to methane ratio in the atmosphere. And then by taking the ratio of the atmosphere ratio of the atmosphere over the pipeline yields an estimate of about 100% contribution of natural gas to the methane enhancement in Boston in the winter and about 2/3 in the summer. Next slide is 14. So this shows basically the map of natural gas consumption that we created. It's anchored to EIA monthly state sectoral total statistics, and then it's spatially disaggregated with a few different proxies. The main proxy used is a real estate database of building square footage by fuel type. The reason that we chose not to use population to disaggregate is because not all towns have gas service. So level zero, sort of first guess, don't put natural gas where there's no gas service. Then we also included gas consumption for industrial and users and power plants by using sort of EIA data that you can get for individual power plants. So all of those users are included in the denominator. Some previous studies have made the assumption that it was all coming from residential and commercial, for example, but we're actually including the entire consumption term for all users, including by the pipeline companies themselves, in our denominator. So slide 15 shows just some summarized results from the stilt, where the Wharf stilt footprints and an inversion framework. So the panel on the left just shows the same map, but with the 50% influence contours for the two sites from the sort of summation of all the footprints from the afternoons from the entire year. So the Copley Square footprint is quite a bit larger, about 80% larger than the Boston University footprint. So there is some spatial information coming out of the having those two sites at different heights. And then the panels on the right just show the observation model comparison after optimization for the annual average, the diurnal average on the left panels, and then the scatter plot of the daily points on the right panels. Okay, so slide 16 shows the sort of overall summary of our results for this work, where the upper left panel shows the average methane emissions in total and from natural gas by season and the annual average. And then the upper right shows the consumption term for those same time periods broken out by some coarse sectors. And then the lower left shows the ratio of those two. So the result is that the computed loss rate is about 2.7% plus or minus 0.6%. And you'll notice that there's not any statistically significant seasonality in there, and some people were surprised by that, but we don't know if that means that there's not actually, you know, seasonal drivers in there, or that, or if, you know, multiple compensating processes are occurring.
Okay.
So then this is just a summary of comparisons with bottom-up estimates, and then sort of just trying to scale those results to give people a feel for how much methane that is. So the EPA greenhouse gas inventory for distribution, transmission, and storage, the implied loss rate is about 0.7%. So we don't claim to make a comparison to that because, of course, this is just Boston and not representative of the national average by any means. But the Massachusetts state also does an inventory based on EPA methodologies applied to our state. So it is accounting for the fact that we have old infrastructure. It knows, this inventory knows that we have more cast iron pipelines. And so, therefore, the implied loss rate is higher than the national average, 1.1%. But our result is still about 2 to 3 times larger than that. And then there's some other, there's direct reporting by the natural gas companies, both to the EPA and to the EIA. Those don't really get you there. And then there's also this term called lost and unaccounted for gas, which is not supposed to be a direct loss, but it's supposed to be an accounting term only. Quite a large range in reported numbers by companies on that term, but the average does seem to come out about right. So I don't know if that's a coincidence or not. So this scales to about 0.3 teragrams of methane per year from the whole region. So that's about half of what Eric Kort saw at the Four Corners, I think. And that's all for my portion. So now I'm going to hand it over to Marianne for the CO2.
Hey, Catherine, before
yeah.
you move on. I think I've told you before, this is a fantastic paper and really cool work. I guess the only comment I would make, back on your slide 11, looking at the urban gradient of methane. So I guess the comment is, since this is, you know, NASA CMS and there's a heavy remote sensing
for
focus,
sure.
the only comment I have is that, you know, looking at those enhancements, they're not very large, and I would say, based on these kind of numbers, that we can't expect in the near term that any satellite or column measurement is going to be able to tackle this kind of size enhancement. Those are, you know, for example, with TROPOMI, even with its improved capability of what we have now at GOSAT, we're not going to see, this is not going to stand out in the column.
Right, and this is an example of a city that you would expect to have quite a large methane enhancement relative to many other cities. On the other hand, we're not in we don't have the topography to support sort of an urban dome the way you do in LA. So on the CO2 side, it'll be interesting. Well, I mean, it'll be on the methane side too. It'll be interesting to see what type of column enhancement the FTSs.
I think it speaks to the fact that there when it comes to these sorts of urban point sources, there are really two archetypes. There are so-called dome cities like Salt Lake and LA, and even some very small cities. You know, in other words, the fluxes aren't large, but the enhancements are large because of the inversion and the dome effect. But a lot of other cities are like Boston and Indy and Paris, where they're really plumes and they're dominated by the wind. And
right.
We just need to be realistic about what, you know, the existing and near-term remote sensing is able to do, because it just won't have the sensitivity to see this kind of signal.
Great. Thanks for the comment, Riley. Okay. Handing it over, slide 18, to Marianne.
Hi, this is Marianne Sargent, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the CO2 side of our urban network, which is a little bit earlier on in the process than Catherine's methane work. So continuing on to slide 19, some of the goals for CO2 specifically that we're hoping to address with this is, you know, basically what information can we add to the bottom-up inventories by using these high-resolution atmospheric CO2 measurements. So specifically, what's the impact of urban ecology and land use change on atmospheric CO2? How do things like traffic congestion impact emissions? We can also use CO2 as a proxy for NO and NO2, which are often emitted together to better understand their sources in transport. And then finally, we can refine this method in Boston, which has a very rich data set, in order to then learn lessons we can apply in other places like China, where the bottom-up inventories are less well-known, where we want to do monitoring and validation of their emissions. So slide 20, the methodological framework is quite similar to Catherine, so I'll be pretty brief here. In terms of the atmospheric measurements, we have four Harvard sites continuing on, the ones that Catherine showed, minus the Nahant site, which has been since taken down. And then we're also including in the network a variety of sites from Earth Networks and from NOAA, which are going to add to the network around the Northeast Corridor. In terms of the bottom-up emissions that are going to go into the model, a great deal of work has been done by Lucy Hutira and Connor Gately over at BU, putting together an emissions grid on a one-hour time scale for the years of 2013 and 2014 on a one-kilometer square grid. And they've already completed this for the anthropogenic sectors and are working currently on producing the biosphere fluxes. And then the atmospheric transport model is basically similar to what Catherine described for methane, which is being carried out by our colleagues at AER. And for the CO2, they're going to expand the region to look at the whole Northeast Corridor. So, again, our method is basically we look at the difference between CO2 at our urban site versus our background site, and that's going to be equal to the product of the emissions and the footprint produced by stilt, which gives us a sensitivity to surface fluxes from our particles released at our receptor sites. So continuing to slide, the next slide, here's our expanded Northeast network. So the sites in green are the Harvard sites, which Catherine has already described. And then in light blue are the Earth Network sites, and in dark blue are the NOAA sites. So to start with, we're going to do a similar focus on the Boston area, where we have the Copley and Boston University sites as our receptors for the urban area. And then we use Martha's Vineyard and Harvard Forest and Canaan, New Hampshire as our background sites. And then after we complete the Boston analysis, we're going to expand to a more integrated analysis of the region, where each of the sites shown on here can act as a receptor site, and we treat them all in one, you know, combined picture of where the particle trajectories are going. So moving on to slide 22, with this expansion of the network, one thing that we really wanted to be sure of is that the instruments are all calibrated to the same standard. So because we're looking for a difference between a background and an urban site, it's really critical that that each be on the same scale. So really the consistency is even more important than the accuracy for this technique. So to that end, we sent some tanks around so that common tanks could be used to calibrate all of the Harvard sites and the Earth Network sites that we're interested in. So both Earth Networks and Harvard, we always have a tank out at each of these sites which calibrates several times a day. to track the accuracy of the instruments over time. And then for Boston, we have a procedure where once a year, we'll send out two additional tanks, one high with higher concentrations than ambient and one with lower concentrations than ambient, and use those to get a slope relationship for the Picaro's response to changing concentration. The Earth Network sites, they typically just have their one-point calibration, which is running, and they assume that the slope is constant. So we, by sending these tanks around, we are now going to impose a slope on the Earth Network's data. So here I show basically the difference between CO2 calculated with the Harvard calibration to those two tanks compared to the CO2 calculated with the Earth Network's calibration, which is only at one point. So you can see that the agreement between the two calibrations is excellent near ambient, near 400 ppm CO2 and 1.9 ppm methane. And the dashed black lines show the tank concentrations that were used for calibration. So when you get to some of the higher concentrations in the atmosphere, this slope starts to become more important in if we didn't do a two-point calibration, we would start to exceed our desired accuracy of 0.1 ppm for CO2 and 2 ppb for methane. So we do think that this two-point calibration is important for these Picaros, even though from their specs, you might expect that the slope would be consistent. It does vary somewhat instrument to instrument. So on slide 23, I'm showing some of the BU emissions inventories put together by Connor Gately and Lucy Hutira. So they really put an extensive amount of effort into completing sectors for on-road and off-road transportation, residential, airports, electric power generation, human respiration, industrial commercial, oil gas production. So the left shows the entire domain that's being covered by their emissions inventories, as well as that's going to be covered by the Wharf Stilt product. And then to the right is the zoom in around the Boston area that just shows the on-road emissions, which is obviously very detailed on this 1 kilometer grid. So this is a lot of information that's really going to help this model to give us some of the detailed results we're looking for. So slide 24 shows the Wharf-Stilt framework for this CO2 portion of the modeling. And again, you can see that the domain, the inner domain with the smallest grid is shown in blue, is now covering the Northeast Corridor going down as far as Washington, D.C. And then below is a sample footprint, which shows the surface influence that would be contributing to the concentration measured at the Prudential Center. So you can see that once we put this footprint on our very fine 1 kilometer grid, you get start to see some, kind of speckles in the footprint when you get farther from the receptor. So to deal with this, what we're going to do is incorporate changing grid size. So we'll use this fine 1 kilometer grid when we're close to the receptor, and then we'll transition to larger grid boxes as we get farther away so that we can smooth out the speckled look that is happening there. And that's something we're going to have to play around with to see what grid is able to best represent the atmospheric measurements and the statistics that's going on with those particles as they go back in time. Another thing that we thought about with this new running of the Wharf Stilt was the impact of when we release these particles. So in Catherine's analysis, we had released particles once an hour, all at once, 500 particles. And this time we thought about, what would happen if instead we released the particles over time? So we released those 500 particles through the hour. So you're kind of capturing different parts of atmospheric variability in those two scenarios. In the first, all the particles leave at once, so you're really looking at what could happen to them back in time, where are all the places they could end up. Whereas in the second scenario, you could possibly capture better if the meteorological conditions are changing significantly during the hour. So we did compare those for Catherine's actually analysis because it was all set and ready to go on the methane side, and it looked like there was really no significant difference in the results for those two scenarios. Even when we could tell that the winds were shifting based on the corner selection at the Prudential Center. So we did decide to stick with the method of releasing all the particles once per hour so that we can get kind of a statistical look at where they end up based on one release. So slide 25, the other important piece of this puzzle is going to be what we use to determine our CO2 background concentration. So this is going to be a bit more complicated than it was for methane because you have the biosphere breathing in and out throughout the day, and you have a pretty significant vertical gradient as well in CO2, which you didn't have in methane. So where Catherine basically attributed when the particles leave the boundary, they get the concentration that was measured at either Harvard Forest or Nahant, no matter what altitude they exit the region. For CO2, we're going to add a vertical component to this. So we know the altitude at which the particles leave our region, and based on that, we'll apply a CO2 that is a function of altitude. So on the left here, I show some measurements from the Earth Network Tower, GHG 35, which is in Canaan, New Hampshire. This is one of the taller towers in the region, which has inlets at 50 and 100 meters. So you can see that the 50 meters has a stronger daily cycle than the 100-meter inlet. And to the right are carbon tracker results. So in blue are is carbon tracker for the grid box over Harvard Forest, with the different lines showing different altitudes. And then green is for the grid box over Martha's Vineyard, just to give a sense of one forested site for Harvard Forest and then one with much less biology at Martha's Vineyard. So you can see that the pattern here basically follows the pattern that we see at the Earth Network's tower, where the afternoon values are pretty consistent with height, but then the amount of enhancement overnight decreases with altitude. So we're going to construct a CO2 background basically using this type of pattern shown in the little cartoon at the bottom, where it's tied first and foremost to the observations, but then we use the carbon tracker model to tell us basically how much the nighttime enhancement will be reduced as you go up in altitude. We're putting together this background, which is going to be an important part of being able to get this model to come out correctly. So just to summarize the CO2 portion here, we're going to start with looking at the Boston area in a method similar to what Catherine did. So for that, our receptor sites are going to be BU and Copley, and our background sites will be Harvard Forest, Canaan, New Hampshire, and Martha's Vineyard. And the anthropogenic 1 kilometer gridded hourly emissions are already completed for that sector, and the biosphere emissions are ongoing. And wharf runs are also being completed pretty quickly, so we have 1 month of runs completed of wharf stilt, and further runs are coming online soon. So we'll be putting that together to try to understand some of the emissions in the Boston area. And then after that, we'll expand to a more integrated framework for the Northeast Corridor. So thanks. That's all I had. If there are any questions?
Yeah, thanks both. That was great. A good overview of what you've been up to and some really exciting results. I might start with a few questions, if that's all right. I was going to ask if Catherine had a feeling for how important these sort of large leaks were in terms of the total methane emissions over Boston, and then also what sort of response you've been getting from the sort of energy companies or policymakers in the region, if you have.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Your first question was whether Boston, like the representativity of Boston relative to the national.
Actually, I was wondering if you had a feeling, you know how you said when you drive around you can see that there's some places where there's big leaks.
Yeah.
Do you have a feeling for how important those are, or whether it's more sort of diffuse emissions all over the city?
I don't have a feeling for this at all. This is one of the, there's a whole suite of really big questions that came out of this about why we're getting this result, but why the inventory gets it wrong. And so today there was even, Brian Lamb published his result for the national for a sort of a direct measurement inventory type approach, and he's seeing declining emissions over time compared to the 1990s. He and I independently did a comparison of his measurements just for our region and what we're getting from the top down, and they really don't match up at all. And so we don't understand if that's because there's this sort of broad, diffuse source from many small leaks that are not picked up by an inventory. Another hypothesis is that end users are contributing significantly. That is not in the inventory at all. It is really hard to tell, but for sure those drive around, they make an assumption about what the lower limit is, and it's quite a high number. Like if you take the lower percentile of the distribution of measurements throughout the city, you still get pretty elevated concentrations. So that's sort of an arbitrary cutoff. And then you think about the repeatability and the angle of the car relative to the source, et cetera. So I think your second question was what the response has been from policymakers, utilities. It's been fine. I think policymakers have been really eager to engage, and that's been fun. On the other hand, there's some really fundamental problems with the way that the rules are written and what the financial sort of economic incentives are to doing repairs. And so I think that's going to have to come from there's some reworking to be done of the laws and how in terms of how the utilities are paid and what the incentive structure is for where they spend their money. That's been frustrating because it's hard for me to make concrete suggestions because I think there's some it's really deep into the policy about what the incentive structures are.
I was just going to add that we've been grappling with the same thing in California, and I guess an observation I have on the policy response has been that I think a lot of these field studies like Brian's paper you just cited, and all the EDF funded studies and the one you guys did for Boston, Catherine, are showing where the inventories are struggling and where there are systematic issues that need to be addressed. So the inventory compilers are paying attention and making adjustments where they can. But I would also say that a lot of the policy stakeholders are kind of moving on to the mitigation topic. Now they're saying, all right, how do we specifically do what you said? How do we help provide guidance on where to put resources to do it? And that's more of a leak detection problem. And I think it gets more to the fat tail problem and the super emitters, right? Are you able to find the big bang for buck sources and provide that information in a timely way to people who can fix the leaks? And it's a different focus than the more net numbers that we do to test inventories.
Yeah, I agree. And for example, the utilities they want to put a positive or a proactive spin on this. So for example, they want to know if this framework, because they feel that they are investing into infrastructure improvements, and they want to know if our framework is going to pick up on the results, the fruit of their labor. And, that's a valid question. But they themselves do not have. I think it would be. It's a misconception that the government or the utilities have a good feel for what they thought the emissions would be. I don't think they did, and so they're not necessarily that. They don't really disagree. I haven't gotten the sense that they strongly disagree with our results, or they don't have much basis on which to disagree with the results.
No, they're definitely paying attention. I mean, in California, the Air Resources Board actually took Rob Jackson's, I think, findings for his D.C. study and actually use that to update their gas distribution numbers for Southern California, and therefore change the state of California's inventory, which now seems to agree better with the top-down estimate. So, you know, these studies are having an impact, right, at least at the inventory level.
I have a question for CO2 flux conversion work.
Sure.
Okay, so in your last slide, summary and future work, you mentioned that for Boston area, you will use two sites. So my question would be, what's the resolution of your top-down flux inversion result would be? Would be for the whole area. Are you trying to calculate the flux over the whole area, or you try to calculate the flux at finer spatial scale, like 1 kilometer, something like that?
So, I mean, the scale of the study is going to be the same as Catherine's, which is that 90-kilometer circle around Boston.
Yeah.
So we're looking at the emissions in that region,
mm-hmm.
But the inventories which go into it are going to be at the 1-kilometer scale. So we have the emissions broken down at a very fine scale going into it.
But from the flux inversion, like for the Wolf Stilt work,
mm-hmm.
when you try to calculate the flux from the top-down inversion, are you going to calculate the flux at each grid point, or you calculate the flux for the 90 kilometer square circles?
So when we're close, when we're close into the receptor, we're going to calculate the flux at the 1 kilometer grid point. As we get farther away, we're going to have to use bigger grid points. Otherwise, we're going to, you know, oversample some areas and undersample others.
Okay, but then you have only two sites here, like that would be yield constraint for. I mean, if you try to calculate the flux at 1 kilometer. Resolution. So when you do the Wolf Stilt footprint study for these two receptors, can you cover the whole area, like the map, the footprint map?
In any given hour, we're certainly not going to, but over enough time, we're going to sample quite a large portion of that map. So. Let's see if Catherine had one of those slides in there.
Hi, this is Thomas. If I can just pipe in, I think that the issue is that we don't, you know, the flux inversion we do is we don't do like a geostatistical inversion where we actually solve for the flux at each grid point. It's, you know, we adjust the prior inventory, which is at a given resolution, but we're not trying to resolve, you know, independent pieces of information for each grid point.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. That's a good clarification.
Okay.
This is Catherine. I had one additional comment. In the Boston framework, with the urban measurement sites being right in the epicenter of emissions, that configuration is not really optimized to try and get multiple pieces of spatial information. But for the larger Northeast, I think there is more potential to do a sort of Bayesian or geostatistical type, because you're sort of covering that larger area more densely than in Boston. So that's just sort of a way off maybe type goal.
Any other questions for Catherine or Marianne?
This is Alex Turner. I had a question for Marianne. Actually, two quick questions, I guess. So when you're plotting the footprint there, it's not directly the footprint you get from Stilt-1. Is that multiplied by the prior or something? Or I don't get why it would be so sparse later on.
So this is only for, you know, 1 hour, so, one release of particles.
So then when you do this, I guess, what's the motivation for doing this sort of cruder inversion with simply perturbing the whole inventory up and down instead of doing, say, a standard Bayesian inversion?
I think we want, you know, it's such a complicated system that we want to try to keep it simple at first, and we are hoping to, you know, graduate to the Bayesian inversion eventually, but I think by just using a single receptor site and, you know, there will be multiple parameters that we can tweak to try to, you know, make the measurements look equal to models. But if we use a simple framework where we just start with one site and see how the model compares with the measurements, I think that'll be a better learning curve than trying to put everything together at once.
Okay. Then the other question I had was about the releasing particles versus once per hour versus releasing them through the hour.
Mm-hmm.
This might be just my misunderstanding, but I thought the releasing them once per hour is because we're using time average wind to reduce mass dilation. So did you change how Stilt was reading in the wind field to do this, or did you?
I guess that would be a question for Thomas. I don't know the details of that.
Yeah, so we do use time average winds, but they're not necessarily averaged over the whole hour.
Okay.
They're averaged over the output interval of the Wharf model, and that depends on the grid spacing of each nested domain. So in these runs, I think the innermost domain is we use 10-minute averaged winds. So there would be a difference. Whether you release them over the hour or adjust at one point.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, well, I'll thank our speakers again very much for the nice presentation, and then ask anyone who wants to talk about an in-person meeting for the working group to stay on the phone, and then anyone who's not interested in that, feel free to hang up. So thanks again. That was great.
Thanks, everyone.